Sandra Boynton is one of our favorite guests. She is a popular cartoonist, writer, and songwriter. Since 1974, she has written and illustrated over 50 children's books and 7 general audience books, including 5 New York Times bestsellers. She's also written and produced 5 albums of award-winning children's music. But did you know that Sandra Boynton wrote a book about chocolate for grown-ups twice? Boynton's classic Chocolate, The Consuming Passion returns updated and redrawn by her for a whole new generation of chocophiles. While in this new year, many of us have looked to ban chocolate from our diet, Sandra Boynton is here to help us celebrate it and incorporate it. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Sandra Boynton to the roundtable this morning.
Thank you so much.
Happy New Year. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Is it the new year already?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. It's
hard
amazing.
To believe, isn't it?
Hard to believe.
This book originally came out, 1982? Am I right on that?
Yes.
So what brought you back to it?
Well, the chance to make chocolate tax deductible for the year was irresistible. And then there were other less noble reasons. Now, the book had been out for 16 years, I think, and you know, sold well and people liked it. And little by little, it became out of date in the late 90s. And the publisher kept asking me to redo it. And I thought, well, I've done that. And I was working on other things. And then the whole craft chocolate movement that started in the, you know, maybe about 2006, 2007 started drawing me back in because it really has been a revolution in chocolate.
So there is something new to say and for us to learn about chocolate
There are many new chocolates to consume. So I took this one for the team and I sourced inordinate amounts of chocolate and, you know, was willing to do it for you, the people.
And for that, we thank you.
No, it's nothing.
At what point did you realize that you were onto something in when the book originally came out, that, oh, I'm not the only one who is interested in this and is obsessed by this substance?
It's actually, it was sort of startling the way it really started. I was known for doing greeting cards at the time. And the publisher I had, Recycled Paper Products, was wonderful about doing any card I wanted to do, no matter how peculiar. And I was in drama school at the time and dropped out. And I thought, what card would I want to be able to send right now? And I did a card. On the front, it had a despondent-looking hippo. And on the front, it said, "Things are getting worse." And inside, it said, "Please send chocolate." And when I did this card, chocolate obsession was unknown. I thought it was kind of peculiar to me and to a few other people that I knew. And this card, this no occasion card, it wasn't thank you, it wasn't birthday, it just took off. It sold unbelievable numbers. And that's what gave me the idea to do this book. I said, okay, chocolate obsession is not unique to me. And I became very interested in actually researching, knowing the history of chocolate and everything I could find about chocolate. So that's what started the whole thing.
The book goes into detail of milk chocolate and dark chocolate and box chocolate and what you refer to as pretend chocolate.
Yes.
I assume that's white chocolate.
Well, white chocolate has its own category. And it actually used to be more pretend than it is, but it's still kind to pretend chocolate because it doesn't have any cocoa solids and it has cocoa butter. It didn't used to have cocoa butter in this country. It could be just basically Crisco and vanilla and a little sugar. But yes, and then there's, of course, carob, which is, as I say in the book, it has all the properties. If you just add sugar to it, it simulates chocolate pretty much as effectively as dirt does.
Handy little fact.
No, absolutely.
So, but I assume the one that we, although maybe this has changed since you wrote the original book, that we, I was going to say most of us gravitate toward milk chocolate, although
that has,
now
that has
dark
changed.
Chocolate is a big deal.
It was very much true in 1981 when I wrote the book, and it's changed. It's still, you know, the largest amount of chocolate consumed and bought is milk chocolate, but actually the percentage is much lower of than it was of milk chocolate. Dark chocolate is very much on the rise, and partly due to people's to chocolate becoming better, to people's palates becoming more sophisticated, but also because of the health benefits. So much as you said early on that you know, we're trying not to eat chocolate. Actually, chocolate truly is. I'm not just making this up. Originally, I was making this up. It turns out to be true. It is a superfood. It is the superfood. The number of different health benefits of chocolate is from everything from antidepression to weight loss, believe it or not, to tooth decay, or to heart disease. Chocolate is an amazing superfood.
And that's good news.
It is. It's great news. I mean, if it weren't true, I would have said it is true, but it actually is true. So it is. It's great news for everyone.
What is it, do you think, about the idea, going back to something you said earlier, that many of us, while we perhaps were obsessed with chocolate, were not apt to tell other people about it?
Yeah, I guess there used to be shame associated with that kind of passion for something. No, I don't know. I don't know why suddenly it became a collective experience. You know, maybe my original book had some small part in that. I don't know. I think it's really maybe more of a zeitgeist thing.
Mm. In your book, you talk about really the Toll House cookie recipe that changed a lot of things.
It changed a lot of things. I think it's 1932. I say in the book, Ruth Wakefield, and it was the Toll House Inn, and she made these cookies up, and I think Nestle actually bought the recipe from her and started making the chips, particularly for her cookies. She certainly changed my life.
And put it on the map as an ingredient and something that we would use in baking and.
Yeah, I think chocolate was much used before that as well. Hot cocoa, incredibly popular for you know years. But I think she revolutionized just the sense of the variety of uses of chocolate, and certainly the cookies themselves are extraordinary. I know, you know, I lived in France with my young children 20 years ago, and we would make chocolate chip cookies for our French friends. And the next time we went and visited after we'd moved back, the local bakery was now making chocolate chip cookies. So there's a universality of appeal.
You have a great section in the book of when it comes to chocolate, boxed chocolate, to actually tell what's inside.
Traditionally there's kind of a chocolate signature on top. Many chocolate makers have a sort of swirl of chocolate that's like the initial. So like an M might be for marshmallow. If there's a skull and crossbones, it's pineapple jelly, you know, just things like that.
As it should be.
But the best way to really tell what's inside chocolate is to stick your finger in the bottom, and if you don't like it, just put it back in the box. No one will ever know.
Move on. Right. And this book allows you, of course, to use signature characters, which, of course, beginning with the hippopotamus.
Right, of course.
What brought you initially to the hippo as something that you identified with?
I don't know. I guess it's my spirit animal. I guess it's or my, you know, in Harry Potter terms, maybe it's my Patronus. I'm not really sure. The sort of flaming hippo with wings kind of thing. I don't know. It's just destiny, I guess.
But you can use that. It's a utility player, right? You can use it in pretty much anything.
It's exactly right. It is a utility player. I think that's true of all my characters. I mean, people ask me, why do you do animals? And the first true answer, the genuine answer is I can't draw people. But the second, it really frees you up because the characters, you can delight in their personality, in their expressions, in the way they approach things without any sort of baggage of, you know, age or race or height or weight. It is, you can delight in the character without there being any unintended resonance of the character.
You also do a great pig, which makes the pig makes many has many scenes in the new book.
The pig does. It's a and I have to give equal time because of their agents to the hippo and the pig. It gets so complicated these days. You know, it's so great when I was young and, you know. But, you know, everyone's got an agent now. So that's the reason, though. And, you know, even occasionally chickens now show up.
It's, chickens, you know, you've the
got
cats.
The cats, you've got, you know, so you just do what you have to do.
Is it also a thing where we who have grown up looking and reading your stuff, that we have an expectation that if we pick up a Sandra Boynton book, that those characters will emerge.
Ah, I hadn't felt that weight until you just said that, and now I feel
I don't want to burden you with more.
Oh no. I think so. I mean, it's interesting because originally, as I said, I was known for greeting cards. So very much, you know, for what people say by adult now is not at all what they were. They were not inappropriate for children, but they were, you know, meant for for all people, but for grown-ups. And so I was originally known as a cartoonist and humorist. And when I started doing children's book, it was interesting that over time, for example, I wouldn't be surprised if this book that we're talking about, Chocolate, The Consuming Passion, I wouldn't be surprised to find it mistakenly put in children's sections, because now there's an assumption that what I do is children, is children's books. And again, it's not inappropriate for children, but it really won't make any sense to children. It's very much written at a more sophisticated level than you might write for young children.
There are recipes in this book.
There are recipes in this book.
Are these your recipes?
They are my recipes, yes. And I taste tested them many, many times. Actually, this time through, my daughter Darcy, who hadn't even been born the first time around, so she's now 25, she was my recipe tester because I thought, wow, I haven't made these recipes in a while. And she's a wonderful cook and pastry chef. So I had her make them, and I got her approval on them. So I think she improved a couple of them with a few suggestions.
Mm. Two of your children are here.
Two of my children are here. Darcy and Devin are here in the studio.
In the studio with us. And I didn't think about this before, but it must be a little weird for them to have books that are older than them.
That's true. I don't know.
Like, you gave birth to the first books and then them. And then,
I know. And they had,
and then like,
you know,
the third, fourth, fifth book.
And the books were jealous because they were first. And then these children come along and they have my attention. I'm not paying the same kind of attention to the
books.
Does
this screw up the birth order chart?
It really does. It really does. So, yeah.
You seem, and as I said, you're one of our favorite guests. We love when you come in. You seem like you still, after all these years, are having a blast doing what you do.
I love my job. I just have so much fun, and my children will tell you that when they're home, I work what most people would say is compulsively. You know, I'm always drawing or writing or doing music stuff, but it's really self-indulgence. It's what I love to do. It's so much fun. I can't believe I'm still getting away with this.
So what do you feel like that you're getting away with?
Well, I feel a little bit like I'm a professional kindergartner. I get to draw and color and play with stuff with my hands and make things up and, you know, make songs up that I sing or other people sing.
Right.
You know, it's kind of, I mean, I certainly wouldn't ever sing on one of the albums. That would kill the sales immediately. I'm not, so I just get to do all this, I just get to play.
When you went from being... Maybe you still identify this way, I don't know, but there's a point where you became a brand.
I hear that. Yes, I guess I've heard that.
But do you not want to think about that?
I don't really, since you know, I'm only I don't have an agent, I don't have attorneys, I don't have an assistant. I'm just me doing my stuff. So there's no marketing strategy. There's no no one else has ever drawn my work. I've never licensed it to be done by someone else. So when I've done other products, like even when I used to do more things like sheets or post-it notes or whatever, I designed them all. Before I did fabric, I did the repeat. Because that's the fun of it. The fun of it is doing it, you know, not handing it over to other people to do. So I think I've become an inadvertent brand.
And I ask this as a serious question, but do you think not having all of the hangers-on, if you will, does that put more pressure on you or really lighten the load?
I think it lightens the load considerably. Yeah. And yeah. I think it might have to, again, it's not a strategy, it's just the way I like to live my life, but I think it might have something to do with my longevity, because no one's voice is going to be, you know, for better or worse, no one's voice is going to be my voice. No one's going to draw the characters the way that I've done them. And so... And, you know, when I've had proposals from other people, let's do this TV show, whatever it is, I've always said no because the pitches always either tend to make my things very cute or edgier than I would want them to be, more cynical. And it's just not me. So but again, it's not philosophical in some sort of global, long-reaching way. It's that it's an important part of my life and what I like to do, and I don't know why I would want to hand it over to someone else. Social media has been actually interesting for me because I got into it very reluctantly. But it's kind of the way, you know, it's kind of the way people think you don't exist anymore if you don't
have to do it.
And it's actually, once I started doing it, it's kind of perfect for me because I'm, in a funny way, back in the greeting card world. I have very shareable content, and it works for me.
When it comes, did you ever go into a foray of animation or have...
I've done some animation of my own more recently. I was just curious about it, so I actually don't know how to use the animation software. I started from the ground up. I did the last animation I did, which is of a song from Philadelphia Chickens. It's a song called Cows, and I did the animation myself, but by doing it as stills, so the way it would have been done. So I did every single frame individually, not using an animation program, partly because I was just curious to start from the ground up and see how to put it together.
Because I can't imagine what kind of voice the hippo would have.
Well, this one, that would be hard. The hippo has only had a voice once, and it was for the Ice Bucket Challenge the summer before last.
That's great, yeah.
And I did a small animation for that because I felt very strongly about doing something for it, because my sister died of ALS and she was also an absolute hippo fanatic. So I really felt that I had to do this, so that when I did this short animation for the Ice Bucket Challenge, I needed a voice for it. And I didn't really have, didn't have an actor around to do it. So I did a scratch vocal myself. And then, because I do a lot of music production, I then took it over to the recording studio, the guy I work with, and said, let's just pitch shift it down for now, and then we'll find someone to do it. So we pitch shifted my voice way down and added formant to it, and I turned into Donald Sutherland. It's the weirdest thing. Honest, the weirdest thing. And so the only time my hippo has had a voice, it's me as Donald Sutherland. It's very bizarre. Is that bizarre or what?
That is bizarre, right. But it sounds cool. I now have to find this. Listen to it, yes.
Yeah, I'll send it to you.
That'd be great. Yeah. So when it comes to the next project, what are you working on?
Actually working on another album.
Great.
It's called Hog Wild, and I'm particularly interested in trying to figure out if I can do an entire album of infectious beat dance music, but from all eras. So I'm trying to get at the essence of what makes a song that you want to move to. But the one I'm working on right now is called Tyrannosaurus Funk. So it's very much a funk, but it's very retro funk song. So it sort of has a very 70s/80s vibe to it. But right before that, I did a song called, these are all in demo form, called Swing Thing. And it's somewhere around 1950. It's somewhere on the bridge between big band music and rock and roll. It's got that kind of vibe. So that's what I'm exploring right now. This will take a good year or more.
And will you be working with other artists as you have done in the past?
Yes. Hopefully. I've started to reach out to some people. I always like to have a demo done when I... So the first person I asked is Lyle Lovett, and I hope to hear back from Lyle Lovett. I just love his music. And I had once had a conversation with him where he said he might like to collaborate, so I hope that will happen.
That's great. Meanwhile, the new book is Chocolate, the Consuming Passion. It is written, illustrated, and over-researched by Sandra Boynton. Always a pleasure to have you on the program. I wish you a very, very happy new year to you and to your family, and I thank you very much for coming back.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I love speaking with you. It's great.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the new edition of Chocolate, the Consuming Passion is now out. It is from Workman. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.